Experience the Lord of God's presence. Do you see what I mean? That is intrinsic, the ideal, or you can also say to the picture, the human notion is this, I mean, the cross-human story, that is the ideal, and that is the real, they must converge. The older notion could be presented by this picture, two parallel lines with the possibility of, but at some point or other, I think they're coming together, but I think we have a little bit of difference, I don't have to express the rest, but you get the idea. There is no question of anatomy from there. If Berg does not say there is anything from there, and if Berg says Berg comes close, Berg would say this would necessarily happen if human position that here with the organic goes across. That he doesn't say so, but he comes close. David says, even if they interfere, they can't stop. That progress is in this, the idea in the real mental world. And our contemporary father is saying, in a modified way, says, can't stop it.
Yeah, no, let me say
I'm talking about something about
yeah, I think he would say that. But you see, even this difficulty here, in a passage which I have, don't be read it, but I didn't emphasize it, where he says this, he says, so at the death of Romulus, yeah, this was already practically finished. You remember that? Yeah, no, that would be noise. There is one more passage which we have to consider in this context, and I have to leave it. It says at the end of paragraph 33. Larry is at the end, the last bit of it.
That is true, but
that
period, of that period,
there is more of the things that have done for the death. Yeah, in other words, that is an indication of the fact that the proof of the bestness of Rome is not based throughout on solid facts or information, yeah? And that only in part. So there is no, on the contrary, that is what Mr. Kempling did in his paper, that he showed that if one reads the account of the genesis of the Roman state more judiciously, one sees all kinds of doubts which Cicero had of the perfection of that order. But as a sensible man, he simply thought it's of no use to broadcast that because the Roman Empire is here to stay, and let it make the best of it. And let it inject, as it were, retroactively, some justice which was not forthcoming in the earlier period. Yeah? That is what he meant. Yeah. Yes. It could. No, that would be. How could he do that? No, it could only be a specimen. It may be the only specimen known to him, but it's all accidental. But intrinsically, the possibility of any such things must be. Good. I hope this point is now clear, that there is no question of a necessary actualization of the idea. No question. And it is only the assertion which is perfectly compatible with Plato and Aristotle, and which is even explicitly made, if ironically, by Plato, namely that the best of him was actual in ancient Athens You know?
Nine times as happily as the tyrant. From the point of view of Fletcher. Good. And you can see whether this is really make a proof that such an art of mathematics exists. But the most important habit regarding our subject is a very great one in the dialogue statement 284E. I've only brought the English translation. Well, you read to us.
Clearly, we should divide the art of measurement into two, on the principle enunciated by dividing it at this point. One section will comprise all arts of measuring number, length, depth, breadth, or velocity of objects by relative standards. The other section comprises arts concerned with due occasion, due time, due performance, and all such standards as have removed their abode from the extreme and are now settled about the mean.
Yes, very important. In other words, this is a statement made not by Socrates but the Eleatic stranger, but still Plato asks us to listen to that Eleatic stranger too. And he says there are two art of measurement. The one is what we call mathematics, but there is another art of measurement which is trans-mathematics. And why? Because it is not merely concerned with relative length, meaning this is greater than that, which in absolute terms means this is 4 miles long and it's 1 mile, still relative, but with an absolute standard. How a given action or given whatever it may be looks if viewed in the light of the proper. Of the proper, the right. Now, when Aristotle speaks in his Ethics of practical wisdom as the intellectual core of virtue, he speaks of virtue aiming at the right mean. Mean is also a mathematical consideration, of course, yeah? Whether geometrical or arithmetical. Doesn't make any difference. But the right mean is here not like the geometric or the arithmetical mean, but the right mean between too much and too little. And Aristotle refers to the fact that if he praise an action, or for that matter also a poem, or another statement, the highest praise is there is nothing too much and nothing too little. These are quantitative terms. But nevertheless, these are not terms in of mathematical sciences proper. And I believe that this is makes very much sense to me to say this corresponds to what Plato thought about the subject. So if you want quantitative considerations enter, of course, in action, but in a way which mathematics as such is not able to solve, because there comes in a non-mathematical consideration, the right meaning. Someone wanted to say something. Mr. Lang. No. Hippias is in a way the most ridiculous of the two, which we cannot see from this dialogue. You would have to read the two Hippias. The two dialogues on Hippias. Now Hippias was much less pretentious than Protagoras, but he was a jack of all trades. He could possess all arts. For example, he showed that every piece of clothing he had on himself was made by him. And this kind of thing. And he knew the list of Spartan kings. And efforts by heart and this kind, you know, and a man pretending to a kind of omniscience which brought out a thought to intelligence. No, I think the highest of these three is prodigal. And his prodigal distinction of name is not, while constantly ridiculed by Sugarestia, is not simply rejected by him. Only a prodigal seems to have overdone it, but that a certain consideration of the correctness of expression is eminently useful, Sugarestia, of course, did not deny. Now, there is one more passage which we should consider for understand the last section, also one of which I hadn't thought before in this connection. And that is very early, in 317 early, 17a, when Protagoras speaks of his peculiarities. The older ones, you remember, they all were Sophists, Thoma, Hesiod, and so on, but they conceived. And I am the one who comes the oldest. Yes? And when he criticizes these concealers, what does he say?
For I do not believe that they affected their purpose. The powerful humans in the various cities did not fail to see through their pretense. And as for the many, they have no understanding.
They don't notice anything, so to speak. Hmm? No.
They notice nothing.
That's all we need. Now, it seems to me that this principle of Protagoras is underlying his final defeat. This speech leading up to wisdom is knowledge, and hence sophistry is the salvation of our life, is based, and the address to the many is based on this view. They don't know this nothing. He addresses this to the many, that the difference and the knowledge is virtue in this sense, because the pleasures and so on can be measured, and in the moment you may have measured, the appearance doesn't have any power over you, which is very good in different things, but not if you are very much attracted by the present pleasure. Now, and what Protagoras says, so that's applied. Well, you can tell them anything. So that is perfect. He acts on this kind of quote cynicism, which in a much more clever way than Protagoras himself did it. Because everyone, of course, even if he has no capacity to cavil with a very clever dialectician, knows that this is simply not true. That that the power of the present attraction cannot be simply overcome by this kind of calculation. Again, I refer to an example of Rousseau, when he says, people say they cannot restrain themselves. And so someone, for example, cannot restrain himself from committing adultery. And he enters the bedroom of his beloved into the night. And Rousseau says, let us make this simple experiment. Erect gallows beneath this window and make it clear to him that as soon as he has enjoyed himself, he will be hanged, then he can control himself. Now, this is of course no longer art of measuring, but counteracting one sensual impression, one image, by another image. And one feeling or passion by another passion, which is a good point. Good. But we should go on now and read a bit more, because we have reached a very high point. We cannot deny that. But we know now, we have now heard Sokrates making propaganda for sophistry. and a very clever one, are good.
Let us suppose this to be our answer to the many humans.
To the many. Yeah. It's very clear now. This is what Sukadev says to the many, or what we the intellectuals say to the many. Yes.
And now, I should like to ask you, Hippias, and you, Prodicus, as well as Protagoras, for the argument is to be yours as well as ours, whether you think that I am speaking the truth or not. All thought that what I said was entirely true.
Yeah, was exceedingly true, marvelous. Now, here incidentally we have perhaps that common deliberation with the other sophists. Do you remember? Which Sokrates quasi promised to Hippocrates in 314b. Now, they agree, of course, with enthusiasm. Did you ever hear, say, a producer of Colgate toothpaste protest against an advertisement for, a clever advertisement for that same toothpaste? Good. Yes. Go
on. Then you agree, I said, that the pleasant is the good and the painful the evil. And here, I would beg my friend, Prodicus here.
Friend occurs very rare. Yeah.
Prodicus here, not to introduce his distinction of name, whether he is disposed to say pleasurable, delightful, joyful. However, by whatever name he prefers to call them, I will ask you, most excellent Prodicus, to answer in my sense of the word. Prodicus laughed and assented, as did the other.
Yeah. Now, Prodicus agrees here, as though he knows better. You only would have to look up 337c in order to see that Prodicus makes a very sensible distinction between two kinds of pleasure and expressing it by different terms. Now, he, of course, laughs, as we see. There is not much laughing going on in this dialogue, as you must have observed. So he sees the whole thing, he laughs not only about Sokrates teasing him, but because he somehow sees that it's a big joke which Sokrates has practiced. And Protagoras enjoys jokes. So does Sokrates. But there is one great difference between Sokrates enjoying jokes and Prodicus. A very obvious one. Sokrates does laugh. You have to imagine him with a poker face all the time. That is part of, he laughed only on his dying day, according to both Zen Plato and Xenophon. And the story in Xenophon is particularly exhilarating because he had a very sentimental adherent and very, in his way, quite charming, Apollodorus, who was completely out of his mind when he heard that Sokrates was going to die. And then he says, how terrible, Sokrates, that you are unjustly compared to death. And then Sokrates said laughingly, would you prefer that I had been justly condemned to death? That's a rare occasion for joking. But as far as we can say, does not laugh. Yes, now here you see here all accept the equation of the good and the pleasant. Even Protagoras does. No doubt about it anymore. Because if a conclusion, how did Hobbes put it so beautifully?
If reason, so oft as reason is against a man, so oft will a man be against reason.
Yeah, but so oft unreason is for a man, so oft a man will be for unreason. Yes, that is quite true. Now?
Then, what do you say to this?
Yeah, he says unreason.
Oh.
I mean, yeah, that term didn't occur. For the first time, Socrates is speaking no longer to anthropoi, to mere humans, but to hombres. Of course they are hombres. Hombres are outstanding men. And if wisdom is the highest, then the man of wisdom will be the hombres by excellence. That's elemental. Yes?
Then, gentlemen, what do you say to this? Are not all actions known of which the tendency is to make life painless and pleasant, and the noble work is also useful and good? This was admitted.
Yes. Yeah, now wait. All right, leave it there. Yeah.
Then, I said, if the pleasant is the good, nobody does anything under the idea or conviction that some other thing would be better and is also attainable when he might do the better. And this inferiority of a man to himself is merely ignorance, as the superiority of a man to himself is wisdom. They all assented.
Yeah, no, wait. You see here first in Greek, it is, because he first said that it seems so. Here it is that it seems so to all. And in the sequel, if you would look up C6, D4, and in 59, A1, all agree. In this single case, in B6, the all is not added. There must be someone holding out. Now let us see what this can possibly mean. Now, that what he says there is action leading to pleasure are identical with noble action. A very tall order. If someone derives pleasure from something absolutely abominable, no man in his senses would call action leading to that pleasure a noble or praiseworthy action. Of course not. And some man here holds out against it. I bet that Protagoras holds out, because he was the one who said only those who derive pleasure from noble things are truly pleasure. 351c. Now the argument here is simply this: action leading to pleasure, no, the good is a blessing, but actions leading to pleasure, i.e. to the good, are of course useful, because that is what we mean by useful, something leading to something good. But they are also noble, praiseworthy. For the noble action is useful as well as good, namely pleasant. One can only say what a non sequitur. Think only, apply it to a case of a bank robber. They rob the bank in order to get to have an enjoyable period in Miami Beach. Or in Hawaii, or whatever it may be. So pleasure is a goal. And then is the bank robbery is useful to that. If they properly did it, you know, they will not be caught. And that is good. But is it praiseworthy? I think no one would say that. They themselves wouldn't dare to praise it. This is a clear sign. No, honestly, this is a clear sign that it is not praiseworthy. Yeah? Now in the next point they all agree, because there is no question of the praiseworthy involved, and therefore there is no difficulty. Yes?
And is not ignorance the having a false opinion and being deceived about important matters? To this also they unanimously assented. Then, I said, no man voluntarily pursues evil or that which he thinks to be evil. To pursue what one believes to be evil rather than what is good is not in human nature. And when a man is compelled to choose one of two evils, no one will choose the greater when he may have the latter. All of them agree to every word of it.
All of us. So that in the former cases, when he says this was acceptable to all, we do not know whether Sukadeva agrees. But here, all of us, that means Sukadeva and Prakara are included.
Oh. Yeah. Well, I said, there is a certain thing called fear or terror. And here, Prodicus, I should particularly like to know whether you would agree with me in defining this fear or terror as expectation of evil. Protagoras and Hippias agreed to this definition. But Prodicus said that this was fear and not terror.
Yeah. Well, just as a distinction made now between fear and anguish on the basis of Kirava. Yeah? Fear and anguish as two different things. There's a reason. The principle of the distinction is of course different, but it is easily intelligible that man makes a distinction between two kinds of expectation of evil things. Yes? But it's always different. Yeah?
Never mind, Prodicus, I said. But let me ask whether, if our former assertions are true, a man will pursue that which he fears when it is open to him to pursue what he does not fear. Would not this be in flat contradiction to the admission which has already been made that he thinks the things which he fears to be evil, and no one will pursue or voluntarily accept that which he thinks to be evil? That also was universally admitted.
Yes, but he doesn't include himself. No one goes toward things. Yes, here the ambiguity depends entirely on something which I cannot render in English. The Greek preposition epi, E-P-I, conception, has a twofold meaning relevant here. I will bring it out by not translating it now. No one goes at peace thing which he knows or believes to be bad. But what one fears, one knows or believes to be bad. No one goes at peace this terrible or dangerous thing. Now, the joke is this, that the word at peace may mean here both after and toward. No one, of course, goes after the bad thing, in the sense of striving for them. But quite a few people face them. Yeah? It's something very different. And this difference is obscured by the use of this particular proposition. But if it means after or toward. No one goes after danger, very few people accept it. But quite a few people go towards them for one reason or another. Face them. Well, if we take the conclusion literally, we would have to say voluntary courage is impossible. Huh? Voluntary courage. And whether we can call involuntary courage. Courage is a great. Yes. It is not clear, as I pointed out, whether Socrates accepts this or not. Yeah, let us read a few more lines.
Then I said, these, Hippias and Prodicus, are our premises. And I would beg Protagoras to explain to us.
It's too weak, to apologize.
To apologize to us how he can be right in what he said first.
Let us stop here. Socrates calls here Protagoras before a tribunal. You see, Protagoras had this terrific triumph. Socrates had shown, or if it was a triumph, Socrates had made the best a Madison Avenue statement ever made in favor of Socrates, yeah, of Protagoras' big pride. And now comes the anticlimax. Now he is called before a tribunal consisting of Sovereign, Prodigals, and Hippias. And Prodigals and Hippias at any rate are his competitors, not a pleasant prospect. Good. Yes?
To explain, to apologize to us how he can be right in what he said at first. I do not mean in what he said quite at first, for his first statement, as you may remember, was that whereas there were five parts of virtue, none of them was like any other of them. Each of them had a separate power. To this, however, I am not referring, but to the assertion which he afterwards made, that of the five virtues, four were nearly akin to each other, but that the fifth, which was courage, differed greatly from
the others. That's the one, it doesn't say the fifth. But that one differed very greatly from the other, namely a courage. Yeah.
And of this he gave me the following proof. He said, you will find, Socrates, that some of the most impious...
No. Also, that is not this. And he said that I would find, would realize it by using the following proof.
Realize by using the following proof. Of the most impious...
No, that is literally quoted what Protagoras said before. For you will find Socrates.
For you will find, Socrates, that some of the most impious and unrighteous and self-indulgent and ignorant men are among the most courageous.
Will find human beings who are most impious and unjust and incontinent and ignorant, always in the superlative, yet most courageous. Mm-hmm. And through this you will realize that courage differs greatly from the other parts of virtue. Now let us stop here, and I think we cannot go from there. Now you see, Socrates, when he says here, what you said first, and I don't mean what you said right at the beginning, but only right at the beginning of the text, which is not very nice of Socrates, because he rubs it in that Protagoras has shifted his position. That is not nice. But on the other hand, he acts now as a judge. He tells him, you will be held responsible only for what you did last, i.e. for what you did after deliberation. Also a judicial principle, this was, the first was done without any malice prepense, and the second was. Now here is again another repetition, and a thorough comparison of B2 to 6 with 349, D5 to 8. Would be a good exercise in learning how to read Plato. And the changes are much greater than they were in the case of when Socrates quoted what the human beings say for the reason indicated. Let me see. I mentioned only a few points. The position of impiety and injustice is changed. I.e., impiety and injustice are presented as interchangeable. I believe we simply have to stop now. And we will have a meeting next time in which I hope we will finish the Protagoras. And if it is all right with you, and if I can physically make it, I would say we should meet next Monday for a kind of free-for-all, unless for the aesthetic purpose of having any fireworks, then for the very pedestrian purpose of enabling you and more to write a reasonable term paper, a reasonable exam paper, not term paper. And this paper would have to be written on a week from Wednesday. Okay? Now, you had a problem. Is this acceptable to you? Or are there some among you? Yes? No, let us be quite exact. Today is the 17th. A week? Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And you wouldn't like that. We must have a uniform ruling. Now, if it were so that we would, I mean, provided I can make it, if we have our overall discussion next Monday, there would be no difference. Or is it already prelim day?
No, the prelim
is Wednesday. All right. What about this proposal? We would meet next Monday for the dress rehearsal, and a week later for the examination. Does anyone have a reliable calendar? What shall we do?
Are the buildings locked up?
I think so. Yeah. Now let me think sharp. Today is 74. Now what about June the 3rd? No, the prelims begin on the 26th, and they end?
June 2nd.
So the first day, if one considers the need for recuperation, would mean it should be a bit later. Should even be on the 7th of June.
Unless there is any day on which somebody
is Isn't Friday available to everyone?
May I make this proposal? That you have a kind of deliberation among yourselves and tell me the result of your deliberation at the beginning of next meeting and we fix it. I surely do not wish anyone mental or bodily health will suffer from that illness.
Do you want to deliberate after Mr. Strauss goes?
But that is done, however, with an understanding, even today, of some permanence. I mean, things that modern man has invented this difference between laws and constitutional laws. The one can easily be changed, the other can be changed with very, very difficulty. That's one way of doing it. This didn't exist then. Because they conceived of the relation between laws and constitution as much closer than these two. When you study also politics, you will see this very clearly, that for example in a democracy, the question must always be raised, is this a democratic law? The fact that it has been established in a democratic manner, say by majority vote, does not yet make it a democratic law. The majority can be fooled about what it should be. Now, and this broader concept is the permanent right here in the notion of the regime, and somehow, while democracy is now on the assume you have full democracy regarding the two sexes, you can say, well, a man who is old enough to fight is old enough to vote, yeah, as the president has said, and say so that it's more democratic to have the voting age down to 18, but I don't believe you can bring it down to 12, yeah? Although there may be people, God knows, but then it would become, you know, there is a certain limit where these things, further progress in selection ceases to make sense. Now, if there are definite limits, even of the most democratic society, then it is whatever its limits is, it is susceptible of being stated finally at a given time. That's all which is required. Is this clear? I mean, in any notion of change, you know, when you read people like John Dewey, everything is, that is not, if you look more closely, they can't get through with it, you know, that, I mean, for example, if someone would say we can have a democracy without, and the whole idea of elections might be abolished, I think that would be absurd, you know? What should this mean if you are ruled, governed by people who have not been elected by this? Some details of electoral law might be changed, but the basic idea is that it must be the men responsible to the people and the helm must be elected officials, cannot be abandoned without abandoning democracy. In the moment you replace the Democrats, the appointed elected officials by technocrats, you change the democracy into technocracy. And the great confusion that you say the concern is not the democratic machinery, but the democratic end, namely the common welfare. But that is, of course, in that moment you cease to be a democrat. Yeah? And when you say, I want to create a public welfare, regardless by what means, then you can also resurrect Henry VIII.
Can I just
clarify
that?
Yeah.
Because
this remark we just read, yeah. No, I do not believe it contradicts it, but it surely shows that Cicero had no objection in principle to the idea of one man, wise legislator at the beginning, laying down the whole blueprint for the whole society. He only thinks that it is likely to be inferior to a blueprint which emerges in a sequel of generations, provided there are wise men always who contribute their share to its improvement. Yeah?
On what principle
do
the wise men
and people
like this become changed?
Well, that is.
How does the
yeah, for example, the Romans felt to begin with there should be a king, command of the army in war, and the peak of the magistracy in peace, should go in there. They made the experience of the degeneration of kingship into tyranny, and then they said, they abolished kingship. And introduce instead the two consuls, yeah? There must be some monarchic head, especially with a view to war. By splitting it into two consuls, they thought they have the minimum requirement, one leader of an army at a given time, and at the same time not all the military power concentrated because there was another consul at this time. The question is, let us assume men at the beginning, without any political experience. They surely would not have been able to foresee all these things. That's what you are driving at. Now, what Plato and Aristotle, for example, assume is this, that after people have lived for some centuries in cities, not merely rustic, then all the typical experience has been made, so that they can be stated, reduced to principles, and then we can say something final about that. And I think that is also Cicero's view. And therefore Laelius can later on say to Scipio that you only attribute to the old men that they had done wisely what, as a matter of fact, happened only in response to accident. And that, I believe, is the great difference between modern men and the ancients, that we have been brought up, right, to believe that there is no end of new experience. You know? And to some extent that's of course true. For example, who knew anything of a technological society and of a modern democracy? Don't forget that until the American experiment had succeeded, let's say sometimes in the 19th century, the case against a large democracy was unsupported. Others, it was a city. Yeah. 20,000 citizens, or I forgot the exact number. One doesn't know that, but the estimate. Where did you find the democracy? Tribes, sure. Uncivilized. Or if civilized, only cities. Where did you find a large state like France as democracy? As a public is, didn't exist. As the Dutch, yeah, but that was a very small thing, you know, consisting of 11 or how many united provinces, where the real unit was individual province. Yeah. That was a very imperfect union compared with the United States. The United States were the first proof that you can have a large state which is republican and any democratic. You know? And after that, other things had proved to be possible, which had been regarded as absolutely important. A famous example is that of the public debt, which was regarded when it came up as an absolutely impossible thing. Yeah? And, well, you know, that thing is still controversial up to the present day, but I remember the nice discussion in Macaulay's History of England, yeah? When he proudly showed that ever-increasing public debt was a sign of ever-increasing public prosperity, and the whole old fogies were completely suited. You know, there has been some reaction from time to time against that. But generally, to come back to the principles, modern man is more inclined to believe in the possibility of ever new inventions, political inventions, than any. That is a great difficulty which we have to overcome. Now, in order to understand that issue, it becomes important to see the subtle difference between that ancient writer who seems to come closest to the modern view, yeah, and that modern writer, on the other hand, who seems to have stated this principle most clearly at a fairly early date, Cicero and Bergen, on the other. That's the reason why this issue is of some importance.
Is there any major issue then?
Plato, yeah, that is of course a very long question. How shall I try? One would have to break it up to make it a sensible discussion. In the first, surely such a thing as the Roman Empire was greatly different from the political organizations which played on other terms. Mm-hmm. When Alexander the Great made something which was no longer in any way, no, for Plato and Aristotle, the situation was very simple. You have three types of organization. The tribe, yeah, a free but savage. The Eastern despotism, say the Persian Empire, civilized but unfree. Civilization and freedom together only in the polis. Only in the polis. It doesn't mean that the polis could not be ruled temporarily by tyrants, of course it could, but in its nature, it was opposed to this possibility. Is it clear? Now, when Alexander came and conquered the East and established his Macedonian Empire, Aristotle was opposed to it. Yeah? Aristotle didn't like it at all. Yeah. what was Aristotle's thought without looking at any recondite reports, one can say in advance. You can't have civilization and freedom combined in such a large thing. This is no, we begin to understand it again because we have the problem of these terrific agglomerations of population. Yes, the problem of the urban municipal society today, of course, reminds us of the fact that their preoccupation with size was not merely aesthetic, because they wanted to have something which can be overlooked from one hill, you know. Secondly, Aristotle would have said, look what happened to that PC thing. After Alexander's death, it split into parts and you got four despotisms, fatal to any public spirit. Only they were split in Greek now, and some they had their courtiers or orators who or physicians around them who continued the tradition of Greek science, but what is now called Alexandrianism, you know, a kind of mere scholarship without elevation. That was the time, okay. But Rome was a different story, because in the first place, the Roman Empire worked, yeah, much more than the Hellenistic state worked. Yeah, but, and it was, of course, they got into very great troubles, as you know, the Civil Wars. You know, the last century was seven, and then you got Augustus, but that was after Cicero's time. And Cicero was writing with this view in mind. There had been a very great and healthy Rome, and that is praised here by Scipio. That was already 100 years before Cicero. And Scipio was thinking back even beyond that. It is difficult to say where Scipio stopped, you see, because the book is fragmentary. But I think he doesn't go much beyond the moment when the power of the plebs was clearly recognized, yeah, as a part of the world, say about the 3rd century. I don't believe even it went so far, but that would be the maximum. So from a certain moment on, the thing came out, became too big. But Cicero has no choice. Rome is there in this tremendous empire, and you have to make the best of it, and that's what Cicero is trying to do. And part of that is, of course, done in the Republic, although we can no longer trace it clearly because of the fragmentary character of the book. Cicero may very well have thought, for all we know, that this has come about by some mixture of chance, errors, and sometimes also wise decisions, with which he has to live, and of which he has to make the best. But let us assume other people, Romans of that time, might have said, no, the Roman Empire, by giving peace to the whole Mediterranean area, and the whole inhabited world, bringing it all under one rulership, has brought about a higher state of political organization than the politics is. Then theoretically that would mean they would have to show cause why such an empire ruled from one city, is really politically superior to a confederacy of free and independent cities. That's a long question, which is was still discussed very seriously by Montesquieu in his Spirit of Law. Because Montesquieu had understood the classical position very well. And then he writes the question, can you go beyond the city to larger units? And what are the good reasons in favor of it? Well, a very obvious reason, of course, against smallness is the necessity of defense. Say a state like France can defend itself, other things being equal, more easily than a city state. To which Montesquieu replied, yes, that's all right. But that you can get by a very strict confederacy of sovereign cities. And he gave all kinds of examples from ancient times, especially the Lycian Confederation, which was then referred to by the Federalist Papers as a model of such a republic, the confederacy of cities which could then cover a large territory. And the federationists in the French Revolution had this notion of France, you know, a confederacy of smaller regions which by the smallness of the elements would guarantee the freedom of the whole. And the confederacy would guarantee the possibility of defense of these United States. So, in other words, what we take today for granted, the large unit, yeah, say the nation state, the thing from the city state, that was a problem in the past. But what was, and the only the American experience seemed to prove, and then later on also the experience of France to some extent, and even of Great Britain, although Great Britain it was formerly, and I think Churchill still believes it is a monarchy even today. Clearly, this country was a great example of a large-scale republic, a society which combines civilization and freedom, and is not limited to the dimension of state. That needs a long, and then of course you must go beyond that if you want to get trade notions. What about the possibility of a universal society? A world state. Surely, but these issues were thought through from the very beginning. The answers were usually different from ours, either because they were more fearful or because they were wiser. That's
one more aspect.
Pardon? Yeah.
Well, the
only
way
history would simply mean that what just happened from time to time in response to accidents. That would be, seemed to them fantastic that the product of mere accidents should be superior in wisdom to the product of wise planning of an individual or of a group of wise men. That is the secondary question. Sure. But it does not make sense. It's up to this point. And that this claim that the sequence of accidents should produce something wise is to begin with very unreasonable. You know, Burke tries to get it in by identifying the sequence of accidents with divine providence. But there have been people who believed in divine providence prior to Burke, and were better theologians perhaps, who did not see the necessity of this consequence at all. Burke's thing has much more to do, I believe, with Adam Smith's notion. You know, everyone thinking of himself as the best condition of the wisest result for the common good. Traditionally, everyone would have said, what do you mean? I should in my action not think of the common good, and by this very fact act most conducively to the common good? How absurd. Now, Burke applies to politics on the larger scale, to the broad pattern, what Adam Smith had said of the economic sphere. So Cicero says that it is more likely that a sequence of wise men differing in different ages would by their cooperation, rest of the ages, bring about a wiser thing than any wise man living at any one time.
But you raised the point before that you have to have the society which introduced wise men before you have wise men. Now with Cicero, Plato asked us,
No, you don't have to have a good society for that. You have to have a reasonably civilized society with some political experience. What I'm concerned with only this. Given the amazing proximity of what Cicero seems to say to what Burke says, it is also more important to understand the subtle but the size difference. Cicero is still on the old side, on the ancient side of this issue, and Burke is on the modern side.
attention of the attentive reader to the fact that he understood that Scipio's report, Scipio's statement is fictitious. You know, that Scipio deliberately idealized, that to say also falsified, the Roman past in order to bring out this important point that in which Cicero agrees with Plato and Aristotle, that it is not that it is not to be expected really that a mere sequence of uncoordinated responses to circumstances would bring about a wise pattern. In other words, Romulus was not a wise man in the highest sense. Romulus was, God knows what we know very little about him, but he was a shrewd fellow somehow, who acted shrewd in his circumstances, but who founded Rome somewhat away from the coast, not because he had deeply reflected on the defects of maritime cities, but because he couldn't do it. And Scipio attributes him that wisdom which Romulus completely lacked. You know, there was not a sequel of wise men really at the beginning. There were some, it so happened, fortunately for Rome, that the sequel of these actions made at different times finally led to a tolerably good state. That I think is that he would admit that the old Roman constitution, as it existed at the time of the Second Punic War, when Rome succeeded in defeating Carthage, was a good constitution, but it was not brought about by wisdom. And that this should have been this Rome, brought about by chance rather than by wisdom, should have become the most powerful state in the whole Mediterranean. Does not yet prove the superiority of chance to wisdom. That was also a matter of chance, as it worked out that way. That is, I think, what is driving it.
Well, what about the
mystery
of the problem with
now, let us assume, yeah, but that is, I think, the mixed regime is understood here as the just regime, because it gives each part its due. So a just solution can be brought about even in private life by unjust men. Unjust men, if they are sufficiently balanced in power, yeah, they the solution by which they may abide might be the just solution.
The family was
could
we turn now to look at one
justice.